You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Healing Process. This is Lecture 6, entitled Medicine and Anthroposophical Insight into the Human Being, Number 2, given at The Hague on November 16, 1923. Today I hope to explain some points from yesterday's general presentation in more detail. Even today, however, I will not be able to provide more than a few suggestions to stimulate your thinking. Of course, I could present many proofs of statements that can be made about medicine from the anthroposophical perspective, but we would not be able to discuss them all in the short time we have available today. Yesterday I pointed out that by training our inner cognitive faculties, we learn to distinguish four members of the human constitution: the actual physical human body, the first suprasensory member, which I call the etheric body. As I said yesterday, we need a technical term for this, so please do not take offense at the terminology. The astral body, which I also discussed yesterday, in its connection to kidney function. And finally, the human eye organization. Whenever we speak of the human being, whether healthy or diseased, we must always be aware that the sharply delineated functions of these four members of the human constitution intervene in and interact in both sickness and health. We get a real idea of health and illness only when we are able to envisage the human being as a totality, as the confluence of these four separate levels of functioning. As I mentioned yesterday, disease processes are natural processes. Unless we understand the subdivisions in human nature, even unbiased observation cannot draw the line between so-called normal, healthy processes in the human organism and disease processes. Without this understanding, we fail to realize that whenever the intervention of one of these members in the totality is greater than it should be, abnormal pathological functioning results. We have no concept of how sensory and suprasensory forces work together in the wonderfully structured human organism unless we are aware of a fact that I recognized on a conceptual level more than 35 years ago, but have dared to speak about only in the past 2 years. That I have only recently found the courage to state this issue demonstrates that research of this sort is conducted in as conscientious a way as what we usually consider scientific research. The issue is this: we must also subdivide the human being differently. One such subdivision is the sensory nervous system, which is localized primarily in the human head. Considering the reality of the human body, we can say only that this system is primarily localized in the human head organization. It is actually spread out over the entire human body, and the three or four subdivisions of the human constitution interpenetrate. Footnote: Steiner speaks of both a threefold human constitution of body, soul, and spirit, and a fourfold makeup of physical body, etheric body, astral body, and the I, or essential self. End of footnote. The sensory nervous organizing principle is most pronounced in the human head, but our actual head organization, or sensory nervous organization, is distributed over the entire human body. The next system, which we can call our rhythmical organization in the broadest sense, plays into our sensory nervous system. The rhythms of respiration and blood circulation are the most prominent phenomena in the rhythmic human being. But we must also consider other rhythms: the rhythm of sleeping and waking, the rhythm that is expressed in digestion, in the narrower sense, and so on. Here again, the rhythmic system is distributed over the entire human being, and is only primarily found in the central part of the body. The third system that we must distinguish is the metabolic limb system, which can be discerned in several different ways. This is the system that serves human movement above all. Once again, it extends over the entire human body. The two systems of metabolism and movement are definitely connected, as you may discover from the observations that follow. Although these three major systems intermingle, they are distinctly different from one another. The physical, etheric, astral, and eye organizations work totally differently in our sensory nervous system, for example, than they do in our rhythmic or metabolic limb systems. All four members of the human constitution, physical body, etheric body, astral body, and eye, are present in each of these three spatially somewhat separate systems, but affect each one in very different ways. We can speak correctly and precisely about human health and illness only when we know, for example, how the eye organization or the astral body intervenes in the head system. Let me illustrate this with a concrete example. Let's look at the head organization, or rather at the sensory nervous system, as it is localized in the head. Of course, everything we say about it also applies to the totality, although it is less applicable to the rhythmic system, or central part of the human body, and to the metabolic limb system. The essential aspect of the sensory nervous system, however, is concentrated in the head, and can be understood by taking the head as an example, although with the reservations I just mentioned. It is also true that the human being is all head, but at this point I am talking about the head in the narrower sense as the primary seat of the sensory nervous system. To speak about the human senses with precision, we must realize that the activities of the sense organs extend into the interior of the human body. What do we encounter in our sensory system? Here, too, I can provide only some sort of direction. Human sensory activity is usually explained in extremely abstract terms, as if it were merely a collection of concepts. The terribly amateurish explanations we find in physiology texts deal with the anatomical and physiological foundations of the human senses, but their actual functioning is never considered in concrete terms. This is the true state of affairs. Digestion, to put it roughly, is a denser version of blood circulation. Conversely, what circulates in the blood is a refinement of the digestive process. And the sensory process is a refinement of respiration, or conversely, I might also say that respiration is a denser version of the activity of sense perception. These two processes differ quantitatively, but not qualitatively. This fact explains why the methods of the Indian philosophy of yoga, intended for developing a deeper cognition, do not use the ordinary nerve sense processes, but involve a specifically modified form of respiration. What is supposed to be achieved through this modified breathing process is nothing other than a denser, more earthly cognition. And yet there is indeed a deep wisdom in pulling the activity of cognition down into respiration. But what takes place in the senses and moves inward is in fact a refined, spiritualized respiratory process. Where sensory perception initially takes place, as in the eye, E-Y-E, and ear, the eye, capital I, being, and the astral body, must be able to function as freely as possible within this refined respiratory process, so that their effects are really transmitted to the physical structure of the organs. What is the situation in the eye, EYE? First, we have the eye's physical apparatus. Within it is the etheric body, which takes care of vital functions. Then we have the human astral body and eye being, which must not only work independently in the eye, EYE, but also take hold of its physical substance. In line with what I pointed out yesterday, the functions of the human organism must also be found in the external natural world. But when natural processes take place inside the human organism, they are disease processes rather than healthy ones. Nonetheless, any activity inside the human organism always corresponds to a healthy activity in outer nature. In the natural world, the counterpart of the senses is most apparent in the function that is held fast in quartz or silicon dioxide. You must understand that what appears to you as a solid body is in fact a living process. All solid bodies are simply solidified processes. Thus, wherever we observe silica or quartz-like rock in the natural world, and silica, although it is present in other natural substances, is most prominent in quartz, we discover a counterpart of what happens inside the human body in the eyes or other sense organs. These organs do not contain quartz in any substantial sense, but they do include functions or activities equivalent to those occurring externally in quartz. Again, when we observe what happens in our sensory organs, which proves identical to the quartz process, we find that it is least compatible with the activity in phosphorus, which is also suggested by the external natural manifestations of these minerals. Consider the natural process that has solidified into phosphorus as a living activity, and then consider the living interaction between the two mineral processes. This interaction is the same as the one that takes place in the human eye, EYE, which is typical of human sensory organization as a whole. The interaction of one process, similar to that of phosphorus, and another one similar to that of silica, allows the human capital I and astral body to work into the physical structure of the EYE eye. The physical structure must always provide the foundation for the spiritual element to mediate in the right way. Now, let's look at a different example, the process that occurs in the eye, EYE, when the phosphorus and silica processes work together intimately and harmoniously. If this were to continue into the brain, we would be subsumed by our sensory activity and be totally given up to nature. To be human, however, we must lift ourselves above the natural level. Therefore, the process that takes place in the brain must be different from the one that occurs in our senses, and the brain's activity must separate us from natural processes. What happens in the eye, EYE, is only an enlivened continuation of an external natural process. Our sense organs are like bays or gulfs extending from the natural world into the human body. In contrast, what happens in the brain needs to be separate and independent. And this separation is accomplished through a process that can also be found outside us in the natural world. The process in the interior of our sensory nervous system that transforms perceptions into mental images, if I may speak in psychological terms for the moment, corresponds to the external activity we find in lead. Thus, when the perception captured by the EYE eye makes its way deeper into the sensory nervous system, it must encounter a process similar to that of lead. This process alone transforms the brain into an organ of thinking instead of an organ of perception, making it possible for us to think about what we perceive and to become independent as human beings. It is characteristic of the organization of the human head that the process taking place externally in lead must also occur in our heads so that human thinking can arise. At birth, lead is present in our nervous system, that is, the activity of lead is there, although the presence of the actual substance cannot be confirmed. But what happens if the effects of lead descend into digestion and its aftermath? Life sometimes brings this about in the form of lead poisoning. The symptom complex caused by the action of lead in the human metabolism and limbs is more or less characteristic of senile dementia, or cerebral arterial sclerosis. The drug picture is that of age-related deterioration of the human organism. In other words, the process that secures our independence as organic beings when it works in the brain causes specific symptoms of disease when applied to the opposite pole, namely to the digestive system and the related limb system. Thus a disease process in the metabolic limb system is a necessary organic function in the sensory nervous system. If we view sclerosis as slow dying, we must also say that a weakened form of sclerosis is the normal condition of the human head. The three members of the human constitution are so different from one another that the normal condition in one, the sensory nervous system, is a symptom of disease in another. Yesterday I said that our approach to treatment must relieve the astral body and the I-being of functions they must perform when a disease process runs rampant. What must we do, then, in cases of sclerosis? We must treat sclerosis by relieving the human astral body in the digestive limb system of what it has to do in an aging, deteriorating body. We can accomplish this by administering a specific dose of lead. Consequently, we have developed a remedy, listed as number 1 in our catalogue, for arteriosclerosis. A true understanding of the human being makes it clear from the very beginning that sclerosis can be overcome to a significant extent by introducing lead activity into the human being in the right way. However, it is a question of making the lead effective. Simply administering lead as such is not truly effective. Here, knowledge of other members of the human constitution will help. It helps to be able to distinguish between regenerative and degenerative forces in the human organism. The latter are active in processes such as sclerosis, where the body is falling apart. In the head or in the brain, the human body is constantly falling apart because the brain is always in the grip of a mild form of sclerosis. Sclerosis is inherent in the structure and functioning of the brain. Thus, it is extremely important to be able to distinguish degenerative processes from those of vitalization, namely the activities of growth and regeneration. When we are able to properly distinguish these two types, we realize that the human organism as a whole incorporates the vitalization processes most completely in earliest childhood. At that point, the body is focused only on growth and is not yet overburdened by the organs that serve thinking and other soul activities. When we consider milk's relationship to the infant human organism, we discover that the form-giving forces that the human body needs in infancy are inherent in milk. Later in life, we still need form-giving forces, but can no longer get them from milk as we did in infancy. Even very old people still need sculptural, form-giving, formative forces to guide absorbed nutrients into the body's structures. Nothing fosters these sculptural, formative forces and the assimilation of absorbed nutrients better than consuming small amounts of honey. In fact, the effect of honey on the metabolic limb system of elderly people is very similar to the effect of milk on the brain, especially the infant brain. This phenomenon suggests that honey's specific formative forces cannot be discovered through chemical analysis, but only by recognizing relationships between the human being and substances in the external universe on the level of life. Upon closer examination, it becomes evident that honey's effect on the human organism enables the astral body, in particular, to exert its formative forces. Honey's formative ability can be supported by adding sugar, if the patient tolerates it. Consequently, our sclerosis remedy contains lead, honey, and sugar, intermingled in a specific way that combines their functions as well. The need to mingle their functions suggests the importance of how such a remedy is made. In a certain sense, the lead forces must be made to work together with the forces of honey and sugar in the preparation itself. The production method allows the remedy to take over the sclerosing activity when it is introduced into the human organism. When the astral body and the eye are relieved of these forces, They are then able to work on behalf of a normal, healthy human constitution. The preparation supplies a function that the eye and the astral body formerly had to carry out in the diseased body. Once the remedy relieves them of this function, their activity is no longer diverted to dealing with the disease process. The most active ingredient in this remedy is lead, which takes over the sclerosing activity because of its own inherent sclerosing tendency. Combining lead with honey and sugar provides the means of moving the lead through the sculpted forms of the organism to where it is needed. In producing our remedies, we deliberately incorporate elements that can take over pathological processes. In addition, however, these remedies include other ingredients and are processed in ways that enable the active principle to spread out in the organism in the right way. As you see, our methods of formulating remedies are completely rational. These remedies have been used in a clinical setting in the Institute in Arlesheim, and Dr. Wegmann has been able to observe every step of the process. When we use our methods, we know what is going on in the body, and we know that if we administer a certain remedy, it will induce a corresponding change. If we then observe the change as it occurs, we are observing the healing process. We are observing what I assumed would happen. This ability to predict is the essential factor in our method. We do not conduct superficial experiments to determine statistical efficacy. Instead, we make rational predictions upon what must occur. When the remedies are tested, we can see almost immediately whether the expected effects are indeed induced. In this same way, you can also see how the silica I mentioned yesterday works in equisetum. I told you that equisetum incorporates silica in a particular way that influences kidney function. Modern anatomical and physiological studies fail to consider that the sensory nervous system can be separated from the circulatory and metabolic systems only on an abstract level. In a certain sense, all organs are sense organs. The kidney is a particularly important abdominal organ in this respect. Using silica, as it occurs in equisetum in the way I indicated yesterday, increases the kidney's sensitivity and positively affects processes in the human organism that stem from a deadening of the kidney's inner sensing ability. Phenomena that are especially prominent in the sense organs are also applicable, although to a lesser extent, to the entire human organism. One such phenomenon becomes especially clear when we observe a particularly striking example of the effects of phosphorus. Human embryonic development is certainly extremely interesting to consider from the perspective of physiology and anatomy. In embryonic development, we see the interaction of two processes that the modern anatomical and physiological view usually fails to distinguish clearly. The first includes all functions related to fructification of the ovum. The second comprises all processes that play into the chorion from the surroundings, from the uterus and the other female organs enclosing the embryo. Chorion is spelled C-H-O-R-I-O-N. Of course, these structures are pervaded not only by the physical organization of the human being, but also by the etheric and astral bodies and the capital I being. Let's consider the first process, which I call the centrifugal process, through which the fertilized ovum differentiates and develops into the embryo. The predominant effect of this activity is reflected in the process that assumes solid form in the substance silver. As paradoxical as it may sound, we discover in silver an activity that can be enhanced to the point of the excretion that occurs when an egg cell is released in the human organism. In silver's functional aspect, we find an external, natural manifestation of the excretion forces at work in the human being. The pronounced excretion effects of silver reveal its tremendous significance, in the appropriate dosage, for the human abdomen in general. Thus, when we introduce silver, in combination with the appropriate binders and additions, into the digestive system, it affects elimination. Silver remedies can have an extremely significant effect on blocked elimination processes. Next, let's consider the centripetal force that works on the embryo from the walls of the uterus, that is, from the outside inward. This action is also reflected in an outer substance, namely phosphorus. Here again we see the significance of the forces at work in phosphorus. They work in the opposite direction from silver, that is, they tend to drive everything into the human being. In the abdominal organs, silver fosters the tendency to eliminate, while phosphorus fosters the tendency to impel inward into the body. Thus, silver essentially calls forth the forms of the physical human body, while phosphorus moves into the body and erases these forms, expelling the astral organization and the eye from the human body. In this sense, silver and phosphorus are polar opposites. In the rhythmic and head systems, that is, the circulatory and sensory nervous systems, phosphorus has another polar opposite, calcium carbonate. When administered as a remedy, this substance also has the peculiar tendency to encourage elimination. Calcium carbonate is the external, natural counterpart of the radiating centrifugal forces in the human being. Consequently, calcium carbonate preparations can be used to alleviate diseases that develop when these radiating forces become too strong. The implications become especially evident when we trace the eliminating effects of calcium carbonate that has been introduced into the human organism. These effects are apparent throughout the body. In the lowest part of the body, calcium carbonate competes with silver, but even there it has an eliminating effect. Throughout the body, calcium carbonate eliminates both fluids and gases. The calcium forces in the human organism, the calcium forces in the human organism also include the forces that underlie exhalation and those that drive warmth out of the sensory nervous system in a cooling process of sorts. Thus, calcium carbonate eliminates fluids from the lower parts of the human body or the metabolic limb system, gases from the rhythmic system, and the warmth, ether, or simply warmth, if you prefer, from the sensory nervous system. In each of these contexts, the effects of calcium carbonate are diametrically opposed to those of phosphorus. As you can see from the symptoms of phosphorus toxicity, phosphorus pulls fluids, or rather dissolved solids, into the metabolic limb system. In this way, phosphorus drives inhalation, or all inward-directed respiratory processes. It pulls the gaseous element into the organism in a way that warms the sensory nervous system. Calcium, the eliminator, prepares a bed for the functions of the astral body and the eye organization in the human body, permitting them to enter. Because calcium drives out certain elements, the astral body and the eye can enter the human being. That which phosphorus pulls into the physical body impels the astral body and the eye out. The most obvious manifestation of calcium activity is that it binds the waking eye, capital, and astral body to the physical body. But what does that mean? It means that I suffer from insomnia. When my eye being and astral body cannot leave my body, I suffer from insomnia. The activity of calcium, if not counteracted by that of phosphorus, is a constant cause of insomnia and all related effects. As soon as you introduce the phosphorus process into the human being, you enhance the ability to sleep. That is, you promote the forces that drive the astral body and the eye out of the human body, which is where they are when we sleep. Phosphorus activity has this capacity to the greatest extent, sulfur activity to a lesser extent. When the irregularities lie in the rhythmic system, we can also use sulfur instead of phosphorus. To treat insomnia with symptoms in the rhythmic system, we will have to turn to some kind of sulfur preparation. Of course, these are just suggestions, but they are intended to show that rational therapy is inherent in all our attempts at rational diagnosis. For example, when I take the physiological approach, I discover a refined sclerosing process in the human head. I link the human being to the natural world by calling the organic function that underlies thinking in the human brain a lead activity. I see this lead process, but without the actual substance, in the sensory nervous system. And I see it as a poison in the opposite realm, the metabolic limb system, where it reveals, in a very destructive way, what is constantly happening on a more subtle level in the sensory nervous system. At this point, however, I also realize that introducing lead activity into the metabolic limb system relieves the astral body in that system of some of its burden. As a result, healing can set in. Thus, I no longer distinguish between diagnosis and treatment, because the two flow together. Once we recognize either the disease or the process in outer nature that can take over the disease process in the human organism, the other becomes evident. A gaping chasm separates modern diagnosis and treatment, but these two disciplines are interwoven and become one through this rational anthroposophic approach to medicine. On the other hand, these considerations also shed light on disease processes themselves. Most doctors are not at all interested when we talk about one particular illness, because they consider it very insignificant. At least, that's the case in Central Europe. I don't know if it is here in Holland, too. For patients, however, this illness is extremely unpleasant. The illness I'm talking about is migraine. To understand it, we need to know that it is caused by an activity that does not belong in the head, a hypertrophied version of the subtle metabolic activity that normally occurs in the head. We need to relieve the head of metabolic activity that does not belong there. How is this done? First of all, we must administer a substance that will take over and perform this metabolic process. After what I said earlier, you will see that this substance is silica. Silica must permeate the sensory system that is irritated in migraine, where it relieves the head of the pathological migraine process. But first we must make sure that silica's activity reaches the head. If we want the preparation to be taken orally, we must make sure that it gets to where it is going and does not become stuck somewhere in the digestive system along the way. To accomplish this, we must make the astral body as active as possible, so that it carries the silica upward in ascending waves through the digestive process into the head. We can promote the upward flow of silica only by making the astral body as effective as possible. This means that all factors hindering the vital working of the astral body must be eliminated from the circulatory system, which mediates between the abdomen and the head. Sulfur does this, so our remedy must contain both silica and sulfur, suitably processed. The remedy, however, is delivered via the rhythmic system, which must work both upward and downward in the human body. As you know, we can follow the upward and downward rhythms of respiration and circulation. These rhythms are best supported by the inherent activity of iron. If we intend something to flow upward, but do not want it to get trapped, or if we want it to remain there without making demands on the entire body, we need to produce a preparation containing iron, sulfur, and silica prepared in a specific way. The resulting remedy, Biodoron, relieves the head of the migraine and then reincorporates that activity into the total human body in the right way. What we have said about migraine, a relatively minor illness, becomes more serious, at least in principle, if we look at the opposite process. The transformed and refined respiratory activity that appears in the sensory nervous system is meant to take place only in the lowest portion of the upper human body, more or less in the area between the lungs and the lower parts of the face. But if this special nuance of human circulation, which now belongs to the sensory nervous process, breaks through into the human intestinal tract, we are again faced with a displaced process. Although it does have a place in the human body, this process is normally localized in the head instead of in the intestinal tract. When it invades the digestive tract, it triggers typhoid symptoms. This phenomenon shows us the true character of diseases in the human being. They are displaced natural processes. All diseases are natural processes that would be quite justified in a different location. In a certain part of the body, the activity that provokes typhoid symptoms is normal, but in the intestinal tract, it constitutes a disease. The makeup of the head must include an element that allows the outer world to work especially strongly there. As we know, we are least aware of our head, but through it we become aware of the outer world. The outer world must flow into our head. Thus, an element in our head allows us to live in the outer world to the greatest possible extent. There are only two parts of the body that make our connection to the outer world possible. One is the head itself, or rather the area I just described, where respiration makes the transition to sensory nervous activity. The other will seem very paradoxical to you, but once we have produced more extensive medical literature on this subject, which will happen in the very near future, you will be able to read how liver activity, in a very different way, also reproduces the outer world within the human organism. A unique characteristic of liver function is that the outer world works in the liver almost as if the body were not there. When an activity that is meant to be concentrated in a location where it can receive external effects appears as an internal effect and in the wrong place, namely the intestinal tract, it dissociates itself from the human organism on a functional level. Once again, let's search the external natural world for a therapeutic process that can re-internalize externalized activity in the intestines and incorporate it into the body's functioning again. We discover that the appropriate process is held fast in antimony. Antimony is a substance that is highly sensitive to forces in the environment. Its structure is like dynamite made manifest. If you imagine antimony's tuft-like rays and its tendency to avoid mineralization through the so-called Sager process, you can see that antimony is a sentient mineral, so to speak. It internalizes external effects. This ability is particularly evident when antimony is treated electrolytically under specific conditions. If antimony touches the cathode, the slightest provocation produces an explosion. Having seen all these phenomena, we can understand antimony's relationships to the forces playing throughout the cosmos. We can recognize that the antimony process, if prepared and introduced into the organism in the right way, can relieve the eye, capital, and astral body by taking over the typhoid process. The patient's health can then be gradually restored. I have been describing, albeit briefly and in general terms, what we might call, quote, rational medicine, close quote. Our preparations, of which there are now nearly 200, have all been developed over time in one of two ways. Initially, a relatively large number of physicians, all of whom had acquired a certain skepticism with regard to current therapeutic methods, began meeting together. They asked me if anthroposophical insight would be able to discover relationships between the human being and the natural environment that would suggest which natural substances, processing methods, and modes of application might result in effective remedies. As you know, anthroposophy offers a very detailed understanding of the human being as a being of body, soul, and spirit, and an equally detailed understanding of the different kingdoms of nature and their components. My first task was to seek out natural processes and confirm to what extent they represented disease processes. I began by looking at outer nature and proceeded to the interior of the human body. I attempted to discover the effect of the interaction of plumbum metallicum with a sculptural dynamic system such as is found in honey, sugar, or milk. In addition to this remedy for sclerosis, the first method of inquiry, which proceeds from the outside inward, yielded a number of other remedies. Then the question arose, how can we produce these remedies and make them available? I said that I was not in favor of establishing a factory to produce medicines unless it was associated with clinics. So then the clinics were started. And after a number of remedies had been produced, we began using them in the clinics with results that I have already described. I myself am now in Dornach, and the Arlesheim Institutes are associated with the Goetheanum. So I have been able to work closely with Dr. Ita Wegmann to develop another series of remedies by taking the opposite approach, namely by beginning with the disease and searching for the corresponding process in nature. This second method of formulating remedies is the one we have used in Arlesheim, where Dr. Wegmann's Clinical Therapeutic Institute, (where the courage to heal prevails, as I mentioned yesterday, works in tandem with our international pharmaceutical laboratory. If you are interested, you can learn about the remedies produced there. I do not want to propagandize on behalf of our remedies. I simply want to explain their scientific basis. We can have great confidence in them, even on a superficial empirical level, because they can be developed in these two different ways that eventually come together. And it is especially satisfying to have the opportunity to speak about these remedies to an audience such as you. This has been made possible by Dr. Zeilmans, who asked me to speak and was good enough to invite all of you, and by your kindness in attending. It seems that Dr. Zeilmans wants to affiliate this institute with the medical movement I have just described. His intention is that this institute will corroborate what we have done in our own clinical therapeutic facilities, as well as the efforts of a large number of physicians in private practice. As you can see from our literature, we have compiled extensive statistics that are as significant as any other clinical statistics. The confidence our remedies inspire because their results can be predicted is further supported by a great deal of statistical information. It will be particularly significant, however, if we can discover successful treatments for illnesses such as cancer that now require surgery. This effort, too, is well underway. The concept of displaced processes applies especially to cancer, a process that ought to take place only on the outermost periphery of the human body, in our sensory system. It is very interesting to follow the displacement of sensory, and I do not mean neurological activity, from the body's periphery, which is intended to receive it. Elsewhere in the body, this displaced activity appears as cancer. We learn to recognize the peculiarly parasitic character of carcinoma in a more profound sense. Formulating the appropriate remedies is really not as easy as is generally assumed, but we have managed to produce preparations, usually consisting of the sap of various viscum species that can control cancer through medication alone. Our successes, though promising, are still partial, because we have just recently finished building the equipment to process the viscum preparation as it should be processed. Our earlier preparations, however, proved to be very successful prophylactic treatments, though patients themselves usually make it difficult to diagnose cancer early, which is especially important in such cases. Cancers that are diagnosed early can be treated with medication alone, specifically with Arviscum preparations. My purpose today is not to talk about surgery's value or lack of it, or about the fact that it is often necessary. I simply want to point out that a true understanding of the human being permits us to develop ways to treat even serious illnesses, and that these methods are developed from the inside out, as it were. I have now presented the essentials of what I wanted to tell you about our anthroposophically based methodological efforts and the path linking the outer natural world and the interior of the human body. In conclusion, I would like to draw your attention to the great significance of how substances that relieve the human body of disease processes are administered. If it is true that the human being is a threefold being, with a sensory nervous system, a rhythmical system, and a metabolic limb system, then healing too can be subdivided into three processes. The first includes all medications that are administered orally and find their way into the body through digestion. Through injection, we attempt to incorporate healing functions into the rhythmic organism. The third method of healing is through baths, which work from outside and affect the sensory nervous process. Although baths are a rather crude means of working from outside, their effects do involve a lower level of perceptual activity. Let's consider these three methods of administration with regard to phosphorus. Phosphorus, when mixed with other substances, processed by chemical or other means, and administered orally, promotes fluid absorption into the human organism. Suppose we need to relieve the human body of disease symptoms in which the fluid element exceeds its proper bounds, such as certain inflammations, or, say, nosebleeds, to use a trivial example. In such cases, orally administered phosphorus relieves the astral organism in the eye of a pathological fluid function. Preparing and administering an appropriate dose of phosphorus via injection relieves the organism of symptoms related to abnormal circulation. Phosphorus injections can have extremely beneficial effects on such conditions as accelerated respiration, intensified cardiac activity, or excessive rhythmical gall secretion, to list the most obvious. On the psychological side, when brain function causes ideas to overflow involuntarily, so that patients cannot restrain their thoughts and their words bubble over, baths containing dissolved phosphorus will slow down their train of thought. These specific examples of three basic ways of influencing the human body could be multiplied 100-fold. It is simply a question of how to bring about the desired effect. Another therapeutic approach entails directly involving patients in universal movements that act on the metabolic system from outside. Curative eurythmy does this successfully. Eurythmy is something like spiritual gymnastics, but it can be elevated to the level of an art. Frau Steiner has already directed artistic eurythmy performances throughout Central and Northern Europe, including presentations here in The Hague some time ago. In eurythmy, we see an artistic translation of human speech into human movement. If you think of the scientific details known today about the relationship between hand and arm activity and the human speech apparatus, namely that the speech center in right-handed people is located on the left side of the brain, while the opposite is true of left-handed people, Anthroposophy's conclusion that all human speech is related to movement may no longer seem questionable. Consonant sounds, especially palatal consonants, show us how our feet and legs move. When we follow our arm movements, we can see that they too are translated into movements of the air in speech. Linking speech as a whole to the movements of an individual or a group results in artistic eurythmy. Its gestures originate in the entire human being of body, soul, and spirit, while the gestures of ordinary gymnastics arise from the physiological constitution of the physical body. Appropriate movements taken from artistic eurythmy, however, can also be transformed and developed to be performed by patients in a therapeutic context. We have worked out an entire system of curative eurythmy in our Arlesheim clinic. When curative eurythmy is implemented consistently, it works back on the human body and supports internal healing processes, the three types I mentioned, in an exceptionally fruitful way. Curative eurythmy works because the normal dynamic process that results when a person walks, runs, and so on, also works back on internal degenerative and regenerative processes. Because this interaction is highly specific, one set of curative eurythmy gestures will stimulate degenerative processes that are not taking place in the right way, while a different set of gestures will counteract excessive degenerative processes. This therapeutic approach depends entirely on understanding the human being, whether healthy or ill, as a being of body, soul, and spirit. Once we possess this understanding, we will be able to read the meaning of a person's health or illness, and the appropriate treatment becomes evident in what we see. These are our modest attempts at rational therapy. I know that many objections will be raised to such therapy, and that it will be seen as paradoxical or worse by anyone who has expended a great deal of energy on mastering officially sanctioned treatments. This situation is not new, however. I can assure you that I would be more comfortable if I did not have to speak on this subject, because I am personally familiar with all the possible objections that result from accustomed ways of thinking. Believing in the need to introduce something new into our culture, however, is sufficient reason to speak about it. I ask you to acknowledge my responsibility in this regard, and to accept my sincere thanks for your attention to my explanations, which were limited to brief indications by the 2 hours we had available. That is the end of the lecture. There is about 20 minutes or so, I think, here, of questions and answers, which I will now read. Question: with regard to lead and so on, what do you think of the idea that differences in vibration exist? Dr. Steiner: of course, it makes no difference to me how these processes are interpreted. As far as practical applications are concerned, however, the concept of differences in vibration sounds like a theoretical attempt at explanation that may succumb to the same fate as the particle and wave theories of light. For me, what is important is the qualitative aspect, namely, that the function that is merely localized on an outer level in the substance we call lead is equivalent to the internal processes that make the brain a suitable organ for independent thinking as opposed to non-independent perception. This state of affairs is difficult to imagine, because nowadays we are accustomed to an overly schematic view of the organism's inner activities, which we see as extensions of external processes in nature. For example, when we talk about how our oxygen intake transforms carbon into carbon dioxide, we say that a combustion process is taking place. Someone in the audience interjects, "In a nascent state." You took the words right out of my mouth. In physiology and medicine, we often talk about combustion processes, but these inner processes are not the same as external combustion. Processes that are not ensouled or inspirited cannot take place inside the human body, where even the combining of oxygen and carbon is ensouled and inspirited. This process remains in a nascent state, but is ensouled and inspirited. If it continues outside the human being, it becomes a natural process. but it is something else if it remains in a nascent state and works within the human organism. Consider, for example, the activities taking place in the human brain, which I just described as lead processes of a sort. What are these processes in the human organism? This is a very tricky subject. We can study these same actions in the human abdomen, where the transformation of ingested substances leads to elimination. Let's really examine the products of elimination, instead of simply subjecting them to chemical analysis, which is like trying to learn how a watch works by visiting a gold mine and a glass factory, because we know that gold and glass are used in making the watch. Of course, chemical analysis is important, but knowing that a potato contains a certain amount of carbohydrate tells us as little about what it does in the human organism as understanding gold mining and glass manufacturing tells us about a watch. Recognizing the function a potato serves in the plant itself, it is a rhizome, an underground stem, tells us more about what the potato does in the human body. When we know its level of organization, we begin to understand how to compare its processes to what happens inside the human being. For instance, we understand how potato processes differ from those triggered by legumes. The activity set in motion by potatoes ascends further into the head than that of legumes. By studying such details, we eventually realize that metamorphoses occur in the digestive tract, and that excretory products represent activities that have stopped halfway through their metamorphosis. But where are the processes that go all the way? Those processes take place in the sensory nervous system. Sensory nervous and perceptual activities are taken to their conclusion, whereas what happens in the human organs of elimination represents a process that has stopped midway. The contents of the intestines, as paradoxical as it may sound, are an incompletely developed brain. What we see there is simply half of the activity that occurs in the head, but at a different location in the organism. If we keep all this in mind, we begin to see how these processes work inside the human being, and we confront the similarity between the outer activity of lead and the inner activity of the human brain. To verify the details, we can look at what happens with lead. We observe how lead oxidizes and melts. We note what else happens when it melts. We investigate its geological and geographical distribution. We look at how it forms compounds with other substances. These investigations give rise to images that confirm what becomes evident to anyone who can observe the, in quotes, aura of lead, which is similar to the aura of the brain's nerve tissue. I place particular value on such similarities and connections, but anyone can feel free to formulate hypotheses about whether differences in vibrations are involved, and so on. The physics of the matter, however, is not the most important aspect for physiology. Question: are your ways of recognizing the inner processes you spoke about different from the ways available to us ordinary people? Dr. Steiner: it is true that these inner processes cannot be observed with our outer senses or by empirical means. At best, their consequences can be observed in a corpse or in a living body by drawing conclusions from processes that occur on an outer level. The inner activities can be observed only by applying the methods I described yesterday, which you will also find in the books I mentioned. These methods make the human being transparent to insight, so that you actually see the functioning of the liver, for example. This functioning must be isolated on a spiritual level so that it can be viewed. When I look at the human being as a whole, I see a confused mixture of all kinds of different processes. I must eliminate everything other than the liver from view. That is, I must prepare the liver by separating it out on a spiritual level. Achieving the spiritual separation necessary for insight is more difficult with some organs than with others, but it is always possible. With the liver, for example, it is more difficult. But it is also more productive, however, because I am convinced that this is the only way to gain insight into certain liver diseases. Question. Yesterday we heard about a beautifully constructed system, but I still don't understand its basis. You subdivided the human being into the physical body, the etheric body, the astral body, and still another member. If this is true, then it's understandable that we have an etheric kidney, an astral kidney, and still a fourth kidney. But what if it isn't true? First of all, you would have to demonstrate the validity of this subdivision into four constitutional members. It was the same with what you said about therapy. For example, you didn't say why you chose equisetum instead of one of the many other plants that contain silica. As far as I know, equisetum has no medicinal properties. Today you said that you were producing remedies on a rational basis. Prove it. We don't know anything about the functions you are describing. On the whole, I haven't understood your main point. Your whole system is logically constructed, but I failed to grasp the underlying premises. Dr. Steiner. In this instance, everything depends on your grasp of two issues. First of all, as I said earlier, it is not possible to give anything more than hints and guidelines on such subjects in 2 hours. I made it clear, though, how I presented the subject. I made it clear through how I presented the subject that this is a work in progress and that we intend to continue working. When people ask for a, in quotes, proof in a case like this, the underlying concept is not totally scientific, because we have become accustomed to deriving our proof only from what can be observed by means of our senses. No other school of medical thought is supported by proof either, except to the extent that it can be observed by means of our physical senses. I said that sensory observation must be extended and modified by a higher form of perception. Yesterday I pointed to methods for developing this higher perception and cited books that describe them. Admittedly, these methods create foundations for an entire so-called system of proof that I can make clear to you only by means of a comparison. When we stand here on the earth, we have some basis for saying that if we pick up and drop a heavy object, it will fall to the ground. This is an accurate statement with regard to a certain way of thinking based on sensory empirical proof. If we go a little farther, however, we discover a situation I happened to encounter as a young boy when someone said to me, "If the earth is floating in space, why doesn't it fall down?" The way the heavenly bodies and heavenly spaces carry and support each other is an image of the foundations of the science I have been speaking about. There, we operate in an entirely different realm, where the entire system is based on mutual support. Of course, what I say will not seem very well supported if I have only 2 hours to select topics and provide perspectives on a field as exhaustive as medicine. We could provide the proof you want only if we were in a position to base 4 years of professional study on the perspectives I have explained today. If we were to take a truly spirit-imbued natural science as a basis for our pre-med courses, and if a similarly based study of physiology were to lead over into histology, diagnostics, and clinical practice, you would find this thorough approach just as plausible as the modern medical system. Today, however, I can do nothing more than provide perspectives to stimulate your thinking. The first problem, therefore, is that we have become accustomed to accepting only sense-perceptible proof and do not take mutual support into account. This view gives rise to a second problem. If you are doing mathematics or are involved in any other rationally based science, how are you to proceed without allowing one position to support another? Mathematics is based on mutual support. Talking about mathematics for 2 hours would surely be even less conclusive than today's discussion. Although, even in that field, it would be possible to provide stimulus for further thought. Having built a bridge with the help of mathematics, I could then begin to talk about verification. I pointed in simplistic terms to the situation with regard to proof when I said that I place no value on remedies unless the factories that produce them are associated with clinics where we can monitor how the remedies work. Once we have a diagnosis of the type I described, we move on to attempting to heal. If after 2 or 3 days we can see that the remedies are working, the verification is obvious. No other school of medical thought has any different means of verifying its suppositions. Consider the therapeutic action of phenacetin, for example. In that case, the practical verification generated statistics, but the verification itself was indispensable. My point is that today's empirical medicine takes the view that statistics alone are an acceptable point of departure. If that is true, discovering therapeutic connections is a matter of sheer luck. Insight into the human being, however, enables us to transform what was a matter of luck into a rational method of discovering treatments. Today, if we say that the activity inherent in phosphorus, for example, affects the human organism in a particular way, we are supposed to test how it works. And I did point out the possible effects of lead and phosphorus in the human organism. When you say that we cannot describe an internal function as a phosphorus function or as an equisetum function, I must point out that any substance represents only a temporarily solidified state. What is lead? We happen to be able to give it a name because we live in a temperature range at which lead is solid. Under different cosmic conditions, lead becomes something different and undergoes metamorphosis. In reality, we never deal with permanently fixed substances, but only with processes that are temporarily held fast. We can, however, suggest how they are held fast. You mentioned equisetum. Of course, other plants contain the same substances. Let me express myself very carefully. With regard to equisetum, I said that it was representative of the plants that contain these substances because it is 90% silica, which is not true of other plants. In the case of equisetum, the effect of silica predominates. You said that, as far as you know, equisetum is not a medicinal herb. That means only that its therapeutic effect has not yet been observed. We have observed this effect very frequently, however, so it is simply a question of expanding your experience. I understand any objections you may raise. In fact, I could raise them myself. Simply consider, however, the many arguments against the views of Copernicus. The Catholic Church persisted in its objection until 1827, when these views were finally introduced into Catholic schools. Civilization would not advance much if we allowed ourselves to be influenced only by arguments against new ideas. Not that I want to be immodest about what I am presenting here. All of our statements are based on work we have done. What I told you about the effect of minute quantities of substances is not based on frivolity. If you look at the studies I have here, you will find that people spent years verifying these statements in the laboratory. Your objections are valid, but it goes without saying that objections can be raised to any new idea. Comment by a member of the audience. As soon as you accept a theory of general relativity, one is no longer referring to conditions. Dr. Steiner. Yes, but relativity is also relative. I once heard a lecturer try to make Einstein's theory of relativity plausible to his audience by taking a matchbox and a match and saying, quote, "I can hold the box still and strike the match on it, or I can hold the match still and move the box. The effect is the same. It's a relative issue," close quote. I would have liked to point out that nailing the box down someplace would make greater demands on his analogy. At this point, we begin to see relativity as relative. And if we observe the human body in motion, we realize that its movement is not confirmed only by coordinates and systems of reference, but also by fatigue, and organic changes. Here we take a step away from relativity, toward the absolute. We might even say that relativity becomes relative again and approaches the absolute asymptotically. As I see it, the importance of the concept of relativity lies elsewhere. The presuppositions of physics have accustomed us to seeing everything according to conventional theories, relating everything to the course of time and to a location in space, which is how we write formulas in physics. In reality, however, the perspective of physics is not enough. We must consider the spatial relationship of object A or process A to object or process B simply as two attributes. This approach engenders truly fruitful ideas. We begin to see relativity as relatively. And that is now the end of Lecture 6 and the question and answers.